You just have to keep going. You have to want it enough to wake up tomorrow and do the same thing over.
This was me being a hustler.
The only way that I've gotten to this point in my life is to try to treat people the way I want to be treated.
Welcome to Ground Zero Growth with your host, Sam Sapp, owner of Lockbaud.
Hello, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm joined today with my guest, Matthew Entringer, Executive Director with Street Support KC. How are you doing today, Matthew?
Hey, I'm doing great, Sam. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. So right before we got on, we were kind of talking about how last time you and I connected, we didn't quite get into Street Support, I don't think, as deep as I would have liked in retrospect.
Yeah, we had a lot to cover the last time we met. We had a lot of business things to cover, but yeah, we didn't get into Street Support a lot. So I'm excited to talk to you about it.
Please, can you what are you doing over there? What are the folks at Street Support doing over there? What does that look like?
Yeah, so I started Street Support in 2023. So we came up on our 2-year 501c3 anniversary last May, and we are designed, it's all volunteer to help people that are experiencing homelessness. So right now we're doing outreach events on the first Saturday of every month from 9 to 10:30. Near outside the downtown library, and we're just passing out blankets, sleeping bags, food, clothing, hygiene. And so this year we're on pace to do about $40,000 in donations. So we're growing fast, and you know, it's an exciting time to be a part of the organization. And you know, we're just trying to help as many people as we can, because homelessness is a really increasing issue here in Kansas City. So it's been challenging, but it's been really fun too.
So, and I don't mind asking questions out of ignorance, but tell me about this. Tell me about homelessness. You know, you're combating homelessness. Is this something we can combat? Is this something we can, I think potentially for me, maybe even others out there, it seems like the evil that will just always plague us. Yeah. Is there a solution? Is there a world where we can get to and solve this problem?
It's a great question.
Help me.
I think there's a lot that we can do. I don't think of it so much as like an on or an off, right? Like we either solve it or we don't. It's almost like the pressure on, you know, a sink faucet when you're turning it on. Like right now it's on full power and it's splashing all over, but we can get it down to a trickle, right? Because there's a lot of things that go into homelessness beyond just affordable housing. You know, this is all stuff that I've learned in the last few years, because before I started, you know, volunteering and finding Street Support KC, I didn't know a lot about homelessness. So that was a big part of my journey, is just making sure that I understand the issue and I can combat it the way that, you know, that we can try and do it. But, you know, it really goes beyond just, hey, we don't have enough units that are affordable, or, hey, you know, used to see people, or some people still see people and they think, well, if you're homeless, you know, it's probably because you don't have a job, right? If you just got a job, you'd have enough money, you'd have a place to live. And it's really not, you know, that's just one aspect of it. Even if we gave every single person that's experiencing homelessness a place to live now, there would still be homelessness in probably a few months, because the underlying conditions of addiction, like mental health issues, you know, like I said, addiction, substance abuse, there's just a lot of things that go into why people end up on the streets. And once you're on the streets, it gets exacerbated even worse, because, you know, it's like you're working. Some people are working all day. I've met people that are working 40 hours a week, and then they go across the street to the park or their car after they're done, and they sleep until their next shift, right? So I can only imagine what that struggle must feel like when you're like, I'm doing everything I'm supposed to. I've got a 40-hour-a-week job, and I'm still not able to even put a roof over my head. I could see where it'd be very easy to turn to substance abuse and addiction, and then exacerbates mental health and things like that. So I do think there are things that we can do to solve it, but one thing I'm learning is it's a very nuanced problem. It's not like, all right, let's just bring out some hammers and nails and we'll create enough four walls and a roof that no one's going to be homeless. And unfortunately, that solution, I think, will involve mental health experts getting involved, addiction counselors, and, you know, a good job market too, right? It's, you know, I don't know if there's even enough, you know, entry-level work right now in Kansas City to support some of these people, or enough businesses that honestly we willing to maybe take a chance on some of these people who may not have the track record but have turned themselves around and are looking for an opportunity. So, that's not a, when you said, you know, excuse my ignorance for not knowing this, it's like it is a very, very complicated problem. I wish it were a simple solution, which makes it, you know, difficult to solve. But I think the best that we can do street support is to help the people that are there right now that kind of fell off the ladder, of society, so to speak, and then also educate other people on, hey, you know, this is really what we're seeing and what's going on, and these are good people. It's just they're caught up in a whirlwind of, you know, systemic issues right now that make it really hard for them to get out of where they're at.
So what had you connect with this?
Yeah, before I got involved, like, it wasn't, people always ask me, like, oh, were you passionate about this? Did you see a lot of stuff growing up? Did you experience, like, homelessness or have relatives that were homeless? Like, and the answer is, like, no. I grew up in South Dakota. There wasn't a large homeless population that I saw of people. When I moved to Kansas City is when I first really started seeing it and experiencing it. But I feel like over the last 2-3 years, well, especially since the pandemic, we've just seen a big increase in homelessness here in Kansas City. I think there's certain estimates that say, you know, we're up to almost 2,000 people that are experiencing homelessness here in Kansas City, and that's grown 193% in the last, you know, few years. So as I started just seeing it more, and I was living downtown in the library district, in kind of a high-rise apartment, and I would walk to work, and I would walk around downtown, and I just started seeing more and more people that were homeless. And in my building, people would come into our lobby, and they would just, they'd sleep there, and especially when it was cold. There was one time I remember where it was like December of 2021, and we had like 3 or 4 people that were just kind of bundled up in like the lobby, just trying to get out of the cold, and it was like a really bitter cold. And I just was like, I have to like do something. Like, it just felt, I don't know, it just felt bad to see an issue and know that I could help, even if it was super small. So I didn't really know how to help at first. I was like, well, maybe I'll just put like some care kits together and I'll carry them around my backpack. And if I see somebody, like, I'll give them one of those. And, you know, after a few weeks of doing that, I came across this group called Scraps KC. That's a very successful nonprofit here in town that does like creative upcycling and helps teachers with resources for their classroom. And they had, as kind of a side quest, always done a outreach for the homeless on Saturdays in downtown. And they hadn't missed Saturday in like 10 years. And so I had gone, I saw them one Saturday just by chance there. And I came up and I was like, hey, I'm like, do you guys mind if I help, you know, give stuff out, help volunteer? And I started bringing stuff of my own. I started bringing socks and like drawstring bags to help supplement what they were giving out. And then after about a year and a half, I was like, well, I'm really enjoying this. I want to take this. I'm kind of a control freak. So I'm like, I want to kind of do my own thing, so to speak. And, you know, I want to grow it. And I want to, you know, I think there could be something really, you know, here. It's something I'm very passionate about. I just kind of struck a chord that hadn't been struck before. And so the same day I told the people from Scraps KC, I was like, hey, I'm thinking about going off and doing my own thing. They were like, well, that's amazing, because we're actually, our nonprofit is taking off so much that we don't have time to really do this side quest anymore. And they were like, well, we're willing to help you all we can. So it felt very serendipitous, where it was like, I was looking to start something and something had been going for a decade. They were like, you know, we just don't have the time and resource to put into that. And then now what keeps me going is just, we see a lot of the same people at all of our events. So because we're monthly, we see people on a regular basis. There's people I've known for 2-3 years that, you know, my parents ask about, that, you know, that I just know human being level. And it's very cool. And that's what kind of keeps me going now, is the people we serve. And also it's just an awesome volunteer community that we've put together.
That's cool. And I like, you know, I like that you say it's a complicated problem, because I think, I mean, obviously you're right. It's, as people, we simplify it in our head. It's always like I don't know if it's some sort of control mechanism or some way to, you know, we need to tell ourselves that life is easy to understand, because that makes it easier for us to orient ourselves in life. But it, you know, I saw a comedian the other day. It was a little short, right? And the comedian, I don't even think he was in the U.S., but the comedian, it was this, you know, something about affordable housing, and everybody was like, yay, and laughs, and this, that, the other. And he's like, well, okay, how many people, you know, all right, hold up. We'll get there. I'm getting there. I'm trying to remember the exact clip, but it was basically like, oh, where they're at, there's an excess in housing. And he said something along lines of, oh, well, it's easy. If you're a landlord and you're struggling to place people, shouldn't you maybe lower rent? And the whole audience applauds. And then I'm over here, but like, it's not that simple. I mean, I'm not a landlord, but I've noticed the place I'm renting, they are strategically raising rent. Yes. And they're doing it, and it's not necessarily for everyone, but you can tell they're trying to orient themselves in such a way that the riffraff, or whatever you want to call it, exits and a new clientele comes in. And it's so, and then it's like, okay, so let's assume I become a landlord today, right? Do I want to be the affordable housing, or do I want to be the Ritz-Carlton, right? And obviously I'm going to want to try to be the Ritz if I can pull that off. And it kind of seems like the affordable is only when the Ritz is like declined over time and they just kind of like, you know, let's get in on, which is wild, because there's also landlords that talk about how financially amazing the affordable section is, but neither here nor there. What I'm kind of getting at is, it's interesting because, you know, well, why don't they just live, you know, it's like, well, if you have all these and all the newer apartments, it definitely seems like they definitely want to be the Ritz-Carlton, right? Mm-hmm. And so, which again, who can blame them? You know, that's like, wouldn't you want to? But then it creates a world where there's an absolute gap down at the bottom. And then what do? And then we have these studies, too, that say, you know, in a lack of community, people are pretty much naturally going to gravitate towards drug abuse, which creates a cyclical sort of cycle.
Now, you know, the affordable housing thing that you mentioned is really interesting, because you're right. If you have a certain, like a lot of these people, if you've sunk in so much money into loans, right, or if you're financing places or things like that, you're probably hamstrung into how, you know, you have to get a return. I understand, you know, we live in a capitalistic society. It's like you have to get a return on your investment, things like that. I think what we can do on our end, you know, whether it's voting citizens or just the government, is just to continue to incentivize people, make the incentives larger so that we can get more, you know, I don't think there's even a, you know, a lack of, you know, luxury housing, right? Everything is luxury now. It's like you see just about any apartment anywhere in downtown, Crossroads, you know, near the plaza, everything is luxury. It doesn't matter if it hasn't been renovated in 35 years or not, it's still luxury. But what we need is those really affordable units. And that's where, you know, government subsidies and things like that can come in, because I think we like to believe that, like, you know, either like the things like the middle class or things like, you know, not having homeless is like a natural development that'll just kind of sort itself out. It doesn't really work that way. I think there has to be intervention. It's not a naturally occurring organism. It's something that we have to fight against. So I think as we continue to look for ways to make sure that, you know, there's enough affordable housing, people that are on the streets, people that are, you know, can, you know, are one paycheck away from living on the streets, which is like 60% of people these days. It's, you know, how do we incentivize people that are investing in property to make them affordable instead of making them the luxury style apartment? And that's part of the nuance and the complication, is it's all part of the, for lack of a better word, game you have to play when it comes to this, is how do we allocate enough funds for it? How do we create enough resources that we can start to make a dent in this problem? And I think government subsidies and housing subsidies is a big part of that.
When I'm trying to think through, you'll forgive me, and I'm an ideas guy here, right?
Yeah.
Part of the, I would assume, again, I'm not a landlord, but now I really want to be talking to one alongside this, because my assumption is that with affordable housing subsidies, is it's kind of like a take one, take all sort of a thing, right? You don't get to necessarily, I'm sure you can have some degree of criteria, yeah, but you also probably have to be careful. It's not like you can look at the person and be like, I'm pretty sure you're going to trash the place, so I can't admit you until you go through this thing. Right.
Yeah.
But it's interesting, and maybe that goes to show the opportunity for a nonprofit like yours, because I would imagine by contrast they could take funds from nonprofits in a way that still allowed them to, like, hey, you need to go through this program, and then once you're out of this program, you know, or if you're in the program, we have a place for you. And once you're out of the program, we have a place for you.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. what's becoming more apparent to me as I get involved in issues regarding homelessness is it's going to require a cross collaboration of people, right? Because there are, you know, we all have the idea of like, you know, the moral, I don't know, moral justification of there being homeless or no homeless, right? It's like, well, no one believes there's people that are homeless, right? But it's like, okay, well, then how do we put that into actual action where it's like, okay, so-and-so's putting enough money into here. They want to make sure they have a safe return on their investment, or, you know, they have a good heart and they want to have the affordable housing. But to your point, it's like, okay, well, all it takes is one person to ruin that entire investment. And especially when you're dealing with community that has a high level of addiction and mental health issues, it becomes much harder, right? And you may have higher insurance, property insurance as a result of that, right? And so I think that's where these cross collaborations, these teams between, you know, nonprofits and the business world, and how do we create relationships that are able to transcend some of those issues that are very real and understandable, right? I mean, it's the same way that, you know, one thing about homelessness I've discovered is a lot of people say we don't have a homelessness issue. We have a male homelessness issue. That's because about 80 to 90% of the homeless people, especially those in Kansas City, are male. And that tracks with everything that we see at our events. Like, we probably get 50-50. Actually, we probably get more donations for female, but as far as clothes and things like that, but it's overwhelming. 80, 90% are men. And part of the reason is, you know, we see the people that are at the very, like, the lowest level. Like, they can't get into shelters. If they can, it's, you know, it's rare. Otherwise, they're sleeping outside. They're sleeping, you know, in alleyways or doing whatever else. And it's kind of that thing, same thing. It's if you have a room at a shelter and you have, you know, a woman who's 5'6", 120 pounds, and you have a guy that's 6'4", 250, it's like, all right, well, that guy becomes a bigger issue for us to let in, because if something happens and he's experiencing mental health issues or things like that, I don't know that we have the staff to be able to keep everybody else safe from that person, right? And so it's the same. It's there are levels of this where you do have to identify the risks of a group of people that are struggling. I mean, you want to be able to give everybody the benefit of the doubt, but you also have to be practical about the challenges that they're facing and some of the ramifications that can come just from trying to, you know, approach and help that group, right? So, I mean, it's certainly, I think, not as high as a rate of, you know, mental health or addiction or just, you know, people that you can't, you know, deal with. I would say overwhelmingly the people that come through our line are very good, like very thankful, very, very nice. But there is a segment of that population that's really, really struggling and makes it sometimes borderline, you know, dangerous to help them out. So it's a very real issue. So it's not something that I'm like, oh, well, just build it. And, you know, that's you guys' problem. It's a very real thing that, like you said, is probably going to require some cross collaboration with nonprofits, maybe that help with vetting and the actual landlords that own the places.
That's, man, there's a lot there. That's fascinating. I don't know. I think I don't know if I would have realized that, you know, once you said a decent majority of men and whatnot, it just kind of completely shifted and complicated all the variables in my mind.
Yeah.
What a mentality, right? I mean, then let's use your example, right? The example you gave, probably a very real one, is a very fit, you know, or fit enough that like they're a threat to somebody else. That's fit enough to get some real hard work done. Yeah. Something that we're seeing a bit of a gap of in the trades space. If you talk to anybody in the trades, yeah, they're talking about how nobody wants to graduate with, you know, civil engineering or an architectural engineering or like a, you know, I mean, something that's going to maybe require you lay some bricks or something early on. I'm sure I'm butchering it hardcore. I've never been in the trades, but, and then, so this is a person that is capable, and you would hope the role would definitely be out there. Yeah. But to your point, they've got to be a little bit more, the job probably has to be a little bit more unique in the type of person. And then the other thing is that mindset. You have to find that. If you can't, if the mindset doesn't get broken through to, and I saw her up on stage. She was talking about how it's another nonprofit, and she was talking about how when they come back. As she was like, you know, eventually over so many drugs and so much abuse and so much, they're gone. You can tell in their eyes it's a shell of a person. Yeah. And she's like, and when you see that light come back, there's nothing. But they have to, there has to be a choice. There has to be a willingness and a want. And then there has to be a drive to not go back to that, which involves community. And so anyway, I don't know. It's
you're absolutely right. And I think, you know, we see people like that all the time, that you can tell there was a history of drug abuse, right? Like, especially, you know, meth, you can tell based on how they smile. Like, it's not hard to figure that out. But the amount of people that come and they're like, hey, I've got a job interview. Do you guys have like a shirt that has like a collar? Do you guys have like a pair of pants, things like that? And so you see people that are actively trying to improve upon the situation. What I see a lot of, and I don't think anybody starts off being like, oh, you know what sounds like a lot of fun? Being homeless, right? I don't think anybody starts off that way. But I think maybe you find yourself there and it just becomes easier to navigate that world than it is to get back up on your feet sometimes. So I've met people who seem to be very comfortable with the idea of like, no, I sleep outside. I sleep under the bridge. Like, I know where to get food. There's a street sheet the library has that'll tell me exactly where I can get my next meal. Like, I know that I can go to the shelter if I get, you know, cold, or maybe I know somebody that if it, you know, winter gets too difficult, I can go there. But the idea of being like, okay, like some of these people are like, okay, well, I have to get my social security card and I have to find a job before that I can find a permanent residence because I got to have someplace that I can get mail and I can only stay at the shelter for 30 days. And in order to get back into the affordable housing loop, I have to do X, Y, and Z. And, you know, if I'm trying to work 40 hours a week, I can't do that or whatever else. So it just becomes
all the way to get up to minimum wage at a,
right,
you know,
and it's,
and so the, and the, this is just, sorry, I've got a fun analogy.
Yeah.
That, and don't ask why, but the same chemical, don't quote me anybody, but the same chemical that douses your brain during an orgasm, you get 10 times of if you take a meth injection. And so, and if that doesn't have you a little bit like, whoa, I could see why somebody would do that. But then it also, the problem is it short circuits your brain, and your brain does not, that I'm aware of, again, don't quote me, not a scientist, your brain does not produce that same chemical in the same way ever again.
I know that much. I know that I've heard addiction to drugs or any substance depends on how high it can make you, like as far as like the spike in your level, and then how quickly it can get into your system, right? So you think about something like meth, which takes instantaneous, versus like if somebody took a, I don't know, like a marijuana edible or something like that, right?
Yeah.
The things that you can have more quick and things that can hit higher are the things that are really tough. And that's basically, if you were to design a drug from scratch that would do that, that would pretty much be methamphetamine. So it's very difficult for people to kick. And I also think there's still very much a stigma of it. Especially, you know, maybe less so out on the West Coast or other places, but there's still a, you know, meth is a very real problem that's affecting, I mean, I would say most people probably know somebody, right? Because it's not one of those things where you're like, well, only losers and things like that. It's like, there are a lot of people who, you know, get hooked on like Oxycontin after back surgery and then have to go to methamphetamine once their doctor won't write a prescription anymore. Like, and this person was a post office worker or the head of the PTA or whatever else. Like, this is not some group we need to demonize, but unfortunately there's still, I think, a lot of, you know, stigma around that. So if people even do have a system, people are very afraid of like, well, I don't want to tell this person I'm drug addicted and I'm going, you know, I might be homeless. Like, I don't, nobody wants other people to think of them that way. But it, that's where that strength comes in, and that courage is like one to kind of stop you.
And that shame.
Yeah. Shame spiral.
Starts the, for anybody that's ever been addicted to anything. It's, it's, so this is kind of wild. I don't know if I ever thought I'd bring this up, but I get what you're after and I want to bring it out. You know, I used to really struggle with pornography, and it was the shame I would feel that oddly enough somehow reinforced it. I'm sorry, this is deep and it's wild and it's a lot more about me, I guess. No. But when I started openly talking to my wife about moments when I would slip up, the shame went away and it was easier to not reinforce or end up back in the thing. Now, I understand this is much different than, although ironically kind of similar from a chemical reaction like I was telling you about earlier, with regards to meth. But on the same token, I think, you know, you were describing a world where it's, you know, it's like you said, the doctor prescribed you an opioid. I've known people, friends that have, they didn't even realize they were prescribed an opioid until right. they're like, oh, I'm having XYZ. And they bothered to Google and find out it's an opioid, try to go cold turkey, end up going through withdrawals.
Yeah.
And then the doctor's like, why would you ever go cold turkey? It's like, I didn't know it was an opioid and I felt like crap for taking it.
Yeah.
And so, and then you're right. Like, they didn't mind talking about it. So they're out of it and they're fine. But the moment you have a problem talking about it, and then you've got that shame, and then that's also the moment when you want to feel better, right? That's shame makes you want to feel better. And then you go back to the thing that you were trying to flee from to begin with.
Well, we all have, it doesn't matter if it's, you can really become addicted to anything, right? Some stuff can be positive. I've known people who are like, go to the gym every single day, like at 6 o'clock, where it's like, there's no excuse that would even be possible for this person to be like, no, I'm not going to the gym, right? And you could argue like, boy, that person, you know, they obviously get an endorphin rush or they get dopamine off of doing it, right? And so it continues to be, and it also becomes like their source of like stress relief, right? And so that can be food, it can be drugs, it can be alcohol, it can be working out, it can be pornography, it can be sugar, it can be anything, right, that exists, because it goes beyond just, I think,
sugar's a good one too to talk about.
Sugar is one that, yes, and that's what I think I'm trying to kick. And that, but it's kind of similar to your example of like, I didn't know it was an oxycodone. It was like, I didn't know there was sugar in this. It was bread. It was wheat bread or whatever, right? But like, there's so much stuff that I think is out there that the problem is that we just have, there's just things that
we demonize one, but not the other. You say you're trying to kick sugar.
Yeah.
I felt awkward just talking about my thing, you know, and how much more if it's like,
yeah,
the doctor prescribed me opioids. I didn't realize. Then what's worse is, you know, when I was off and they wouldn't get me back on. So I met the guy behind the alleyway and now I'm so far along, help. And
you start thinking that it doesn't matter what it is. You start thinking that the problem is you, when in reality, it's like our bodies are just designed to get, you know, pleasure or happiness or whatever else from anything. I mean, they purposely design, you know, Facebook and Instagram apps to be that way, where you get the endorphin rush every time you check your notifications, right? Like there are things that are designed to get us addicted to it, or to at least capture as much of, you know, either the market or time or whatever else, right? Like,
We literally live in a country where it's like the pursuit of happiness.
Yeah.
And if there was one thing that I hear criticized regularly, it's that notion, because and I think there's a reason they said the pursuit of, but the problem is even the pursuit of is flawed. I like the word fulfillment better, because if you're pursuing happiness, and if happiness is pleasure.
Yeah. It's a temporary state. Like the way, like I heard somebody describe it one time is like happiness is just a temporary emotion, right? Like it spikes, it goes down, but to your point, fulfillment, contentment is really the long-term, you know, feeling that we should be trying to achieve, because it's just not possible to be happy every single second of your life, right? I mean, I don't even know if that would really be good for you, right? Like, because the only way that I've had some really amazing moments is by juxtaposing it to some really low moments that I've had. Mm-hmm. Like, and that's how you know you're happy, is because you're like, well, I'm no longer sad. I'm not where I was before. So I think that's just something that everybody has to deal with, is those tough times. But I think being able to talk about it and being able to, you know, have people that are close to you can get you out of any sort of addiction, whatever else it would be. And you can start fulfilling or pursuing happiness. But first, you just have to remove those roadblocks to you that that make you feel guilt or shame or whatever else. Because if you can't be honest or happy with yourself, you can never be happy or honest with other people that are around you.
That's great, man. So we got in it fast. Let's kind of switch the script a little bit. You know, if we were to kind of rewind the clock, so here's where you're at now, man. This is what you're passionate about. And I love this. And I could tell you've thought a lot about it.
Yeah.
But let's kind of transport you back to kind of the high school, college period, right? Where it's like, you know, hey, little Matthew, what do you want to be when you grow up? But you've also evolved past, you know, in grade school, you could say astronaut, superstar, cowboy, and you do that, Matthew. But then now we're 17, 18, 19, and now it's, I'm sorry, you can't be an astronaut, cowboy, superstar. That's not really in the list. In fact, you might focus these. So you've got these external influences. What does Matthew want to be, and what is the world telling him he needs to be?
When I first went to college, I was going to go pre-pharmacy. And so I was going to do pharmacy. My mom worked in the medical field. She was a nurse. And I just thought that was really interesting. I shadowed a pharmacist in high school. And I was like, oh, that seems like a good paying job. It seems like it's, you know, adjacent to the medical field, which is cool. Like, but then I joined the school newspaper at Creighton my freshman year, just to do an extracurricular. And there was no other guys that had gone out that year. And so they were like, do you want to be sports editor? And I was like, oh, okay. It just started. Like, I was like, that sounds great. And then I started doing more of the communications. I switched my major to journalism at Creighton. The journalism school had like advertising and graphic design and like PR. And so I went PR and I did graphic design. And I thought I was going to like write for, you know, I had like a sports column in college and I won a few sports awards like for writing that sort of stuff. And I thought that was kind of where I was going to go. And then after college, just applied for everything that I possibly could for a job. And just being okay with, you know, maybe doing sports stuff on the side, but getting a job that was in marketing or PR. And so, yeah, I just went into corporate communications for KCP&L right after college. And that was kind of what started on my path to marketing, which I love. And then what I do today, I work, you know, at UMB as a VP of digital media, which is very cool, focusing on digital media and all that sorts of stuff. But yeah, it took a while to get there and figure out what I wanted to do.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. So you're going into college and anybody want to go to for sports editing and you're the only one to volunteer, and that kind of thrusts you into this world of the courses they have at the time are public relations, and which it sounds like. So you did that for KCNL? You did public relations, PR?
Yeah. So I did everything. Yeah. I started off when I worked at Kansas City Power and Light. I did some general.
And so you've always been a Kansas City local.
So I was in Kansas City from, I moved here after college, because I grew up in South Dakota. And so I lived here from 2013 to 2016. And then I worked at Sprint for a little bit, got a little bit burned out. And I was like, well, you know, I kind of miss my family a little bit. I'm going to move back to South Dakota. I got a really good job offer to work at an ad agency. But shortly after I moved back there, I was like, you know, I don't think this is really where I'm supposed to end up. And I remember not being very happy just with where I was at in life. And then within a 2-year period, made my way back to KC, and I've been here for over 6 years. So it definitely, you know, I may have left for a little bit, but I would say KC is definitely my home. And I've always had marketing.
Well, it sounds like we stole you back. So, you know, I mean,
yeah.
You can live around as long as we have your heart.
KC definitely does. But yeah, I've always worked in marketing across all my jobs, whether they've been here or in South Dakota. So, it's been interesting. But yeah, it all started with just randomly being promoted to sports editor the first night I joined the paper, and that kind of took me away from the medical field that I was thinking about.
I want to hear about public relations at KCP&L.
Sure. I did a lot of like energy efficiency and like doing things like that. I've had an opportunity to work for a lot of really good companies that are like, you know, really cool. But I wouldn't necessarily say it was like the most world-breaking type stuff. But they did have some really interesting stuff related to like energy efficiency and like their electric vehicles and things like that. So that was a lot of my PR and answering phone calls at 2 a.m. when the press would call and be like, hey, I see there's an outage. Can you help me work the outage map? So, but I kind of figured pretty quickly I didn't want to answer phones in the middle of the night. So I switched more to more on the digital marketing side where there's not quite as many emergencies. So
were you there when they started sending out the Nests? Like you could get a Nest thermostat?
I think that was before my time there, but I knew a little bit on that program. Yeah.
Why? Are you aware of the program enough? So there's a myth that I think it's a myth that I've heard that like you accept it and they can literally control the thermostat.
Yeah.
It's
called demand gen, like their demand gen program where it's like you can get into it, but then as part of that, and I think you even get like cheaper rates or whatever, but you can control it and they can like shut it down if they need to as a way to like
help. Sure.
So, yeah. I can confirm that for you. Yeah, I think that's even on their website.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, and I believe you. So I ended up getting one, and the way it came pre-programmed, there was an option where like it would turn it down before peak hours and then turn it back up afterwards. But you could shut that off. I think I shut it off.
Yeah, I think you can.
And so that was my thinking. But then I had friends and family that were like, no, they all out control that. And I'm like, seem to have been able to override it every time. I don't know.
It wasn't me. I know I wasn't sitting there moving your thermostat up and down. So
I didn't think that. I was just curious. But so you're confirming it, not myth.
I confirm that there is part of their demand gen program.
Okay. All right. Cool. That's cool. Yeah. Interesting. Unique. Yeah. Well, anybody that accepts an thermostat. So that's right. So you were doing a lot of outreach. Were you going to like classes and churches and I don't know, just different and like, hey, this is why you should install solar panels. Like, help me out here.
So I did more on the I did a lot more of like the media buys and things like that. So I would work on like the things.
What is a media buy? I hear this a lot and this term is still fascinating to me. Like buying media. What are we buying?
If you're going to plan a campaign, right? So say,
okay,
you know, Sam,
marketing campaign.
Yep. Say, Sam, we got $1 million, right?
Yep.
For Lockbutton. And it's like, all right, we're going to do, we got a media campaign we're going to do. We want to get as much awareness as possible. That's our goal. And we say, okay, here's what we can buy for the $1 million is like, one, we think we should have some traditional media. Then we think we should have some digital media. And here's the mix of each. I think we should do some billboards. I think we should do some print. I think we should do some search. I think we should do some social. And that whole thing together is pretty much what we call like the media buy. And so when you work with like agencies or you work with like, say you work with like KCTV and you want to get a spot on, you know,
A radio ad, we need some audio, script, now a voice actor. Obviously, we need the channels, that whole thing. That's a media buy or the individual parts or
the media plan. Yeah. And then like you'd work together to execute the media buy to be like, yep, we're going to buy these amount of spots on, you know, whatever the radio station is or on Spotify or whatever else. So, yeah, that's all part of the media buy. And that's what I do a lot of now is just helping with strategy across, a lot of different companies or a lot of different divisions. How do they plan out their media and how do they use it? And I do the same thing with street sport too, is, you know, how do I make the best use of the limited funds I have to advertise, whether it be our raffles or our donors or whatever else. So yeah, that's all part of the media process.
That's cool. Fascinating stuff for sure.
Yeah.
Especially at scale. So,
yeah, some really cool things you can do now with technology. It's kind of amazing the amount of like insight and data you have access to just when you purchase through some of these like platforms. And we're all tied to our emails, right? We're all tied to our computers and stuff that we use with our IP devices and things like that. And there's just so many different ways you can target people. It's really cool on my side as like a marketing person. And then I get a little freaked out as like the user side of it about how I'm being targeted with ads and things like that. So.
When I was just talking to somebody, he was talking about, he had the formal term for it, but it's exactly what you're describing, where it's like, you know, the goal is to lower friction to purchase, right, as much as possible. And he's been in the retail space for quite some time. And so this was fascinating. He told me that the width of the aisles in a store are a specific width such that you never, when you're leaning over to pick up merchandise, touch the other person's bottom. It's a whole effect where the two butts touch. And if that happens, you will abandon the merchandise.
Yeah,
so they have an entire, like they have a term for it. They have the width for it specifically to avoid that ever happening, such that if you were the merchandise you were looking at, you're statistically more likely to purchase.
That's really interesting. I worked at Sprint and working on the retail marketing side, it's amazing how many things are like science-based that you don't think about. You know, even like you said, like the width of aisles, like the placement of certain merchandise, right? Like the color scheme that you use, things like that, that we all are just like, oh, it's just a random choice. And in reality, like they've put a lot of time and money and energy and probably paid another company millions of dollars to come up with the psychology behind how do we get you to spend more, right, in this store, or how do we get you to do X, Y, and Z? So the science behind that is really, really interesting. I just got just a little bit of a peek at that when I was at Sprint working on the retail marketing team.
When it's wild, and it's the person that helped us with the colors was like a big marketing person out of New York, and they just kind of felt stifled in the role that they were in. So on the side, they'd help small businesses. So for transparently kind of a pittance, I was like, you know, hey, can you help us with our brand guidelines? And they took me down this whole like, what are the colors, and here's what the colors means, what are the font, here's what the font means, and they would have kept going, but I had to stop at the colors and the font because I was like, this is fantastic, this is what I needed was colors and font. I'm gonna have to table for synergy, because I knew early on, I was like, I'm just gonna keep building this creative, it would be nice if it kind of like had a relatively static flow and theme, because you know it's going to be everywhere and it's hard to take that back, so it'd be kind of nice if it meshed. And but it was also wild too, because it was kind of like, okay, as a small business, he's just like a million tasks a day, you know, at some point, typically, you know, a couple weeks in, kind of the max, it's like, all right, we're using these colors and font, whether this is a finished product or not. And so we're going to have to just call this project good and done and paid and everybody's happy, because there's just clearly, apparently so much more to go into. And that was just one aspect. So you're right that and it's also interesting too, because not to be like doomsday, but it is kind of sometimes like, how does the little guy keep up when you have the big guys real deep on, you know, I hired somebody whose full thing is neuroscience for marketing, and they're going to make sure that the subject line is such that 90% of the 5 million people we send it to are going to click and open and buy.
I think that's where I think we talked about this a little bit the last time that we had met, was talking about AI and how, to me, that's like a really good reset for small businesses, where I really see the application of AI being able to supplement the small business owner and being so much more valuable. I mean, you can basically hire the equivalent of like 2 to 3 employees with ChatGPT if you wanted to, if you're able to prompt it and things the right way. Like, I use ChatGPT a lot for different things related to street sport. If I'm like, you know, hey, you know, here's an email I'm going to send. Can you critique this for me? Or, hey, I need to create a social post for about X, Y, and Z. Can you create that post for me? And so I think that's where you're talking about, like, you know, where does the small business owner, how are they able to compete with people that have larger resources, right? I think the AI revolution, so to speak, that's coming will really help small businesses be able to do that, because I'm just optimistic about the universal applicability of AI, as opposed to it's much more democratized than it is, you know, a few companies holding it all and being like, well, you'll get access to it for $10,000 a year. It's like $20 a month. You can have ChatGPT on your computer and be able to use it to supplement what you're doing. But that is that's one way.
I think you're right. And I'm ecstatic. So I did a whole presentation, and the basic notion, and one of my premises was the idea that it's going to become more important that we're people, right? Because the outcomes are going to be based off of the data we put in.
Yeah.
But that's where it gets a lot more exciting. And I think you're very right. And I'm glad you're thinking this way. And I have kind of a perfect example ahead of me. So I was watching. So this is the human element, right? I'm watching this neuroscience guy talk about the weight of your business card, the way the business card looks. And all of a sudden I was readily aware that mine were a little bit more flimsy. And he's like, well, if you're a high ticket and you hand out a flimsy business card, you've immediately created a disconnect in their head. So I'm like, hey, you know, ChatGPT, your neuros, and it helps me flip around like the colors. It helped me do the colors. It helped me do it gave me step-by-step instructions. And here's where it gets kind of wild too. You talk about neuroscience. So on the back at the bullets, and it's like, hey, a couple bullets you should underline because it'll disrupt the flow. And then it's like, you should put an emoji like a shield or a heart. And I'm over here like, shield? What do you want? I don't understand this at all. And it's like, well, next to one of your bullets, maybe the love us or your money back guarantee, you should put a heart that will disrupt the flow. It will draw eye attention, and it will also create an emotional anchor the moment they look at it, because a heart means love, and love us or your money back. They're like, or the flip side, you could use a shield, shield trust. We're a cybersecurity company, or is one of the many things we do. And so, it fascinated me. So to your point, and I think I even told it, I'm like, hey, I watched a neuroscience guy. You're a neuroscience guy now, you know, help me design this thing such that it's going to be effective. And by the end of it, here's where I kind of knew, because my wife isn't typically like the over the top excited type. She looked at the business card and she goes, I actually like that one, I think, a lot. I was like, yes, that might as well have been like guns and so fireworks. And I was like, all right, I think we've got something. And then it was like, hey, who should I order it through? And this is where I think people need to get more intelligent about. There was this post today on like why feeding these things your website is a bad idea because it's learning from them. But here's the flip side, right? I asked, where should I order it from? Like what's, and it gave me rankings. It's like, here's these different providers, here's what they're known for and good at. And by the way, we've come up in these because we're obviously training the machines, they're obviously indexing us. I've had friends be like, hey, did you know you guys are ranked actually pretty well if I ask it for this? Yeah. And so I think you're right. It's like it's a nice reset. It gives us access to something small businesses didn't have before.
Yeah. I mean, you can just do more with your example right there is perfect. You basically hired a brand expert. You basically hired a designer, right? And without having to like leave your office chair, right? Whereas you think about the time, you know, because obviously money is important, but time too, when you're a small business owner, right? It's like, oftentimes it's like you're the only one pushing it forward, or maybe you've got a small team, but like if you have to go and manually, you know, look up all, you know, go to Vistaprint, do all this sort of stuff, you know, compare different options, do all this, whatever else, or, you know, having to sit down and, you know, write out a business card, compare examples, you know, whatever else. It's like, well, that takes a lot of time, right? And that's the other part. You get more time and you get more, more bang for your buck, which is where I think it, you know, on a comparative basis, it benefits small businesses more than it would large scale businesses sometimes.
Yeah. And I think it benefits a lot of folks. So like in that example, right, and this has always kind of been my frustration with creative in general. I love creative, right? It's kind of, I think this is a love-hate relationship, right? I mean, on one hand, there's a limitation of what we're capable of doing on our own, right? But that doesn't limit the imagination, the mind's eye. It's a beautiful thing, right? And so then you have this depiction, but then the odds that the other party is going to create that depiction to the scale of what you have in your mind's eye, it's incredibly difficult. And it's worse when it's like, I never want to anchor down somebody else that's artistic. I'm always kind of, I'm that guy, I'm pretty sure, for people where it's like, use your creative liberty. But then when the creative liberty is like nothing like what you had in your mind at all, but then it's worse because it's like you didn't put a box around it. So it's, so, you know, by contrast, this thing creates a world where let's say it can't do it, right? That's fine. Create me a outline that I can provide to a creative that makes it easier for, so it reduces this back and forth frustration to here's what we're after. In my opinion, it saves kind of the, almost the beta testing phase, right? Kind of like that, we're right around where we're going back and forth. Like, hey, you and me, we're sitting here all day going through ideas before we even have a rough draft. And now we kind of get to skip to prototype.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. It's amazing the speed at which business has just advanced, right? Like what you could do in 40 hours now versus what you could do in 40 hours as a small business owner in 1975, right? It's just entirely different. You think about computer, I mean, it's such a different world. It's like you've got online, you've got the internet, you've got AI that can help you and do all this sort of stuff. And so I really think part of being a successful small business owner, whether it's you're running a nonprofit or you're running a, you know, IT company, is you have to be able to adapt and you have to be able to understand this. And so I have a lot of friends that I'm like, just jump in and start trying it. You know what I mean? I think everybody's nervous to an extent of, you know, ChatGPT, and you hear all these things of like, well, don't feed it X or don't tell it this or whatever else. Or we've all seen Terminator enough where it's like, oh, this is just Skynet with, you know, a different name or whatever. But the thing I keep hearing is like, you know, people, you know, AI is not coming for your job. People that understand AI are coming for your job. Right. And it's the same way with technology, where it's anything that exists. If you don't know how to use the internet and, you know, have a social profile, if you're a business person, or if you don't understand email very well, it's like, well, it's going to be really tough to be a successful small business owner, right? Because there's just so many tools that are out there that kind of just table stakes right now. And I think that's the way AI now is kind of the, in maybe a novelty phase, where it's like the people that want to use it can use it and they get a lot of good value out of it. It's people that are like, oh, it's just a fad. It's going to go away. It's like, it's not going away. Like, jump in, learn how to use it, figure out how it's going to aid and benefit you. Because if you're not, your competitors definitely are. So it's just kind of a necessity now.
Not only is it not going away, to your point about table stakes, I had a friend of mine send me a video. I didn't even complete the video, but the crux of it is what we have now is about to be epically eclipsed, to the point to where, as much as I love ChatGPT and use it daily, I've started to see exactly what they're talking about and where this next gen is going to eclipse it. Because so as is, it so it's been trained, and then it relies on further data input that it then has to reference. It kind of sounds like the next models are going to be self-trained throughout. And so the longer you have it running, the more effective you'll have this child that you'll get to build up over time. And they'll use a fraction of the compute power we have currently. And what we have already is already, yeah, it's eclipsing. Well, and it's a fascinating thing to me, because to your point about the, and it's tricky because, you know, cybersecurity company, obviously we have a tendency to need to be a little bit paranoid. Comes with the territory, right? Flip side, the business owner in me wants to be effective and efficient. So, and here's the worst thing. So, let you know, don't feed it your financials. It's like, well, why? Well, it'll train on it. It's like, and then if Matthew says, hey, how much does Lockbod make per year? It'll tell him because it's trained on my data. But now, like you said, the $20 a month thing, or at least the team workshop thing, it even says at the bottom, they got this little thing, we won't train on your data. It's like, okay, so then what do we do or not handle it? Because the paranoid in me still says, don't hand it your financials. It's like, okay, well, Sam, all right, don't hand it your financials. But why is it okay to put it in QuickBooks? Right. And that's when my argument to myself, I'm arguing with myself here, kind of starts to break down. It's like, I don't know. Why do we give our financials to QuickBooks, but not to ChatGPT? But then also, I think this is the thing that does make me paranoid. ChatGPT is more effective the more data it has. You almost want to give it everything. Yeah. Sidebar, I've recently had it delete all my memories because it creates, the longer you use it, it creates consistent biases. So it knows some of the tools we use. And I started asking it questions like, how do we make this work? and it started suggesting the tools we use to make the things work rather than suggesting better tools. Sure. And so, and then I've also noticed, I don't know if you've noticed this either, but once it comes up with an idea that it thinks is correct, so it will, you know, it's like, it's okay. Perfect example, having it try to kind of help rank candidates in an applicant process, right? And all of a sudden it's got a list 1 to 5. All of a sudden, person on slot 1. I added an additional person. So now we have 6. Person slot 1 all of a sudden becomes slot 6. With the addition of one candidate. If you ask it, why the heck would 1 go to 6 with the new candidate? Like, I could understand them being bumped down to 2 or maybe even 3. I don't know how that works, but you made them 6. And what's interesting is it will affirm you. It'll say, oh, I totally understand. Good catch. Thank you for holding me accountable. And then it will explain why, even though there's no actual logical reason. And it will continually try to fight for its own logic, even though it's clearly insane. It's lost its mind for a moment there.
No, that's funny. I have noticed that where, yes, it starts to advocate for something that you didn't really necessarily ask for, right? I thought you brought up a really interesting point about data. And maybe it's depending upon like the generation that you came up in, right? Like, I find that that's a hesitancy I hear among, you know, either coworkers that are, you know, slightly older than me, or even among relatives, is like, well, it's, you know, you put anything into it, it can use that information against you or whatever else. And those same people are posting on Facebook that they're going on a 2-week vacation and their house is empty, right? So it's like, okay, like there is already that data being put out there. And I guess in a weird way, I'm much more comfortable. Like, I see the benefits of giving it information, and I use it a lot for our nonprofit. Our nonprofit, our reportables, our financials are all public anyway. So there's nothing where I'm like, oh, I don't want people to know how much we're raising for, you know, nonprofits. But I've kind of just leaned into it to be like, okay, like I'm not giving it passwords and bank account numbers, but it's like, I'll take screenshots and I'll be like, here's how much I have when X, Y, and Z, like, can you give us a run rate for the next 6 months of where we're going to be and things like that. So I think you just have to be smart about how you're putting in that data. But yeah, these models all work off of like the more information you give it, you know, especially related to numbers and things like that. I use a lot for just statistical modeling, which is super helpful. And I guess I don't really fear the backside, and I could be open to being people being like, you're crazy. But it is like, it's a risk that I'm like, all right, I'm willing to take it. Like, there's no, like you said, there's so many other systems you put stuff in anyway, right? So it's like, we've all just been, I think we're all just frogs in boiling water. We've all just gotten to a point where we're just giving a machine all the information and bank account passwords that we have. We're all just like, it's got chipped away a little bit at a time from Facebook to now AI. But
well, this will be fascinating. Yeah. So, I mean, you're not wrong. I'm less concerned, honestly. So if we were to talk about, I have to be careful not to go down the paranoia route. It destroys my optimism. But I'm less worried about the AI overload takeover, honestly, and more concerned about the consolidation of technology in general.
100%. I agree with you.
Because, and you know, the CrowdStrike thing is kind of the example I use. So just kind of catch everybody up that forgot about the news. So, you know, rewind back to Y2K. And this was, I didn't even think about this. I'm in a coffee shop and an older gentleman, I bring up CrowdStrike. I'm in IT. It's what I do. Older gentleman's like, yeah, I remember Y2K. We were planning that thing for weeks and nothing happened. And it was like, no, you're not wrong. We had a period of time where technology was antique compared to where it is now. And we freaked out at the notion that the clock was rolling over by a day. Fast forward to where we're at today, and every airport ever that's not flying Southwest, along with a ton of hotels and a bunch of other stuff, shuts down and ceases to function overnight, servers and stuff included, because we threw these things on servers. And I liked the app. I'm not calling out the app here, because I had people that were like, oh, good job not choosing it. And I'm over there like, just barely. They were leaps above. They called out, they did whistleblowing on very strategic, like, other country hack ops, which was why they got street cred overnight, and the IT community, cybersecurity, quickly adopted it. So it's like, so I actually almost bought it. we would have had problems. Our clients would have had problems. Anyway, that happens overnight. That was just an instantaneous overnight thing. And as we throw our data more so into Microsoft, and it's infinite, and it's more efficient. The more you do it, the more efficient it is.
Yep.
Flip side, I hate to say it, folks, but there's we put security controls in place, but the wrong set of circumstances at the wrong time from the wrong. And then all of a sudden we're happy that Southwest is using DOS 3.0 or submarines are running on 50-year-old. Like, I mean, it give or take. On one hand, we get really upset at this antiquated technology. I get upset at this antiquated technology. It's 2025. I have to do what? On the flip side, that's the only technology that worked. When Kansas got hacked, So the entire Kansas legal system at one point was incapable of, and this was like a couple years ago, was incapable of moving anything along without faxing. The only reason anybody was ending up in a hearing or at a divorce case or a prosecution, the only reason any of that happened was because the faxing infrastructure that telcos are really trying to get to go away, and I understand that because it's very costly and nobody uses it. That's the only system that actually functioned for what they needed it for.
It's wild. That's crazy. Mm-hmm. But to your point, which I think is a great one, it's not just even tech, I would say, but it's like across all industries, the mass consolidation you're seeing means there's fewer and fewer choices. And also you're more reliant upon fewer and fewer companies provide the crucial infrastructure that exists out there, whether it's, you know, we've gone from however many airlines to basically four, right? We've gone to however many, you know, wireless carriers to three, essentially, big ones. We've gone through so many internet carriers to however many we have now. And so it really much is, and tech is especially that way. And in fact, they sell it, right? It's like you think about companies like Salesforce or Microsoft, where the whole incentive is buy our entire ecosystem and infrastructure, right? Because it'll make things easier and you can do things over here while, you know, inputting data over here. It's like, that's great. But then if Salesforce goes down, it's like, okay, well, what do we do now? Every piece of our infrastructure, it's not a workaround. It is the system that we have. And so I think that's a really real concern for a lot of businesses, but it's just everything is being consolidated in a way that you don't really have an option anymore, right? Like we've bought different products throughout different companies I've worked at just for another larger company to buy them up a year later. And it's like, well, you're a customer of them, whether you liked it or not. So it's kind of the way it goes, unfortunately. And I guess I'm kind of optimistic, or at least glad, that there are alternative AI sources that are out there, right? It's not just ChatGPT. You've got Anthropic, you've got Perplexity, you've got all these other ones that exist out there. Because this, if we just had one version of it and it was locked, you know, bought by a company, you know, it was Microsoft bought it or whoever else, it's like, okay, well then that changes the entire playground and the play system that exists, right? So this is where I'm hoping that the consolidation, at least when it comes to AI, is not anywhere close. So I hope these companies don't keep buying each other up, because I think the utilitarian view of it, or the benefit to different companies, will be the fact that there are so many different options like DeepSeek or wherever else that you could use to, you know, get AI. So you're not relying upon one company to perform like this massively important thing that companies are going to start redesigning their entire employee, you know, an organizational structure off of, just for, you know, bad Wi-Fi to take it down on a stormy day or something.
Well, I think, yeah, I mean, from an optimistic perspective, yes. I mean, the pendulum always swings kind of like one way or another, right? The more you consolidate this, that, or the other, the more a small business developing this thing that nobody's ever seen before all of a sudden is really a lot more exciting, right? And then maybe they get gobbled up by a big company or whatever. But, you know, our absolute worst case scenario is, and this is really small business, we go back pre-industrial revolution, and all of a sudden you and I are trading just to build a, you know, hey, I you know, you're great at quilting, I'm great at I've got a couple cows, you want some milk, I'll get some, you know, we can, and that, you know, it's the original small business, right? I'm not trying to be doomsday. I'm literally saying, from an optimistic perspective, I think the more consolidated some things get, the more there's it's really exciting when, you know, your local coffee shop is just this great place to be. Yeah. And or your local floral shop, your local whatever, right? And it's like, look, you could get this Amazon, but you can't get this Amazon. You really, really can't. And I don't know if that goes away.
Well, I think it goes back to what you were saying earlier. And I fully agree in the sense that the more and more AI and, you know, artificial intelligence and different algorithms, things like that exist out there that businesses use, it's only going to reinforce how important the people in your business are, because relationships are still going to matter. Like, I know that everybody's envisioning like a, you know, the Joaquin Phoenix movie, Her, right? Where everybody just falls in love with their AI and it's like, well, that's the only relationship I need. It's like, I've used ChatGPT a lot. I'm not going to grab beers with it anytime soon, right? So it's like, it's still very important to be able to have somebody you trust, right? Because to the point you were saying, AI will start advocating for things that maybe aren't the best benefit of your business or whatever else. So I think organizations are still going to need that human connection, that human element to, you know, balance out the AI. And I've seen a lot of companies, you know, jump the gun as far as like, well, we're going to place entire call centers with AI. And it's like, great. And then you see a story 8 weeks later, it's like, we're bringing everybody back. That was a horrible idea. And it's like, yeah, it's like, you can't just drop it on a dime. I know that the technology is exciting and the thought of cutting tens of thousands of dollars from your organization's, you know, payroll sounds really cool. We're not quite there yet. You know, I've been amazed the amount of people that overestimate where we're at with AI, right? But also the amount of people that seem to, yeah, I guess just think that because everything is going that way, that human beings are not going to be part of the equation anymore when it comes to driving business and maintaining relationships and things like that. And I just think it's going to be the opposite where, you know, you're always going to need that human connection. It's only going to go, street sports only probably going to go as far as I can go, right? AI is great, but it's not going to be the one having lunch with donors, asking people to submit, you know, donations for capital projects we're having, things like that, right? Same with you. It's like there are things that you can use AI for when it comes to presentation or, hey, you know, research this company so I have more information so I can tailor my pitch to, you know, something they're interested in. But that alone's not going to lock down business for you, right? It's going to be Sam going out there and talking to people and making sure that they feel comfortable, because as you get more consolidation, I think the benefit small businesses are going to have is that these really large corporations are going to default to email us, call our call center, do whatever else, versus like, pick up the phone and I got you, right? And that's the little coffee shop, your thing, as you're saying. Is anybody can go to Starbucks and be like, oh, great, you know, I buy a $9 latte, but it's like, I want to invest in the company that's here, that's local, that I can talk to. I see the owner every day. Like, that's the part of business that I think a lot of people are still wanting for, is, you know, the local connection that may start feeling more remote as you go more AI.
And, you know, yeah, you're hitting on, and we're in a fun spot. So you're hitting on a great point with how, and this has been kind of my experience. So I'm pro a global economy, right? You know, yeah. Hiring people from wherever you think you can find great people. And I think a huge part of that for me is, and people have this stigma in their head, and I want to relate it to AI. And part of where I like the idea of small business starting to think bigger is, it's like, look, you are going to implement the best version of this because you have to. We had a voicemail the other day, and we were playing it out loud because we were looking at each other. It was a sales call, I think, but we were looking at each other like we couldn't understand it at all. I mean, it was, the entire voicemail was unrecognizable. I'll leave it to the audience to decide whether that was AI or somebody overseas, right? And then you have in your mind, it's like, okay, does that mean they can't speak English with an English accent? It's like, that means that person or that thing sure can't.
Yeah.
But, you know, that, and then in my mind, it's like, how did they get hired? And I don't know the full logistics of that, but I know a small business can't do that, right? So there's this world where you're capable, more so than ever, props to AI, of leveraging enterprise tools and bringing them down to small business. Now I got a nod to my day job, Lockbod. And having it in a way that like you're going to bring the best version of this because you still have the heart. You yeah. still have the need for customer service. If your customers call and think it's an AI robot, they're going to hang up. And that's not to say throw away the baby with the bathwater. That's just to say find the equilibrium where you're fast and effective, but your customers are still getting the customer service. And that's what I want. That's what I want about small business all day long. If I go to enterprise, it's only because I didn't feel like I was able to find the small business equivalent. And even then, right, to your point exactly, enterprise, it doesn't take too long before it's like, I'm pretty sure I'm just a number.
Exactly. No, you're 100% right. I think it's become to the point now where it is like a point of differentiation is to have like real people that you can call and talk to, right? I think everybody's so frustrated where it seems like since the pandemic that like customer service numbers take longer to respond, right? It takes longer to get issues resolved, things like that. Every company, no matter who they are, is always looking to like improve their revenue for the next quarter. So oftentimes it's like, okay, well, we can either grow or we can cut costs. And it's like, okay, well, we're going to cut a call center hour shift. And it's like, okay, well, then you're going to wait longer. But so, you know,
I'm sick of 1,000 prompts that end up at the department that tell me, oh, that's not that department. That's this department. I'm like, I spent the last 30 minutes making sure I selected the right prompt. So why am I still at the wrong department?
Right. Versus like somebody having your cell phone or your email and getting a hold of you, right? It's like, that's how. And I don't even think it's just small businesses that want that. I think even, you know, I've worked for some large corporations. Like if you're the person that's in control or, you know, if you're the person that's responsible for IT services or marketing or whatever else, like I want to make sure when I call my phone, like I can get a hold of somebody right away. Like I don't want to be a number. Right. And so you do risk a lot of that. These companies that are so reliant on AI where it's like you're really not, you know, you're not bringing that human element. And then it becomes just a price war at that point because you're not building any sort of brand equity with anybody. You're just providing a transactional service. You have no human connection. You are, you know, providing services that maybe 10 other companies are. It's like you'll start seeing that over time. Like it may be where you get a short-term bump by these, maybe some of these companies or competitors that are like, let's go full on AI. It's like, cool, you may grow like temporarily. But I just think over the long term, that's not going to be a successful strategy for anybody.
No, I mean, so where, okay, here's what I've started to notice that I find interesting because it's like, what's the end game of this, right? So my personal email, for example, completely abandoned. Anybody that's like, oh, I emailed you at, I'm like, oh, dear God, it's gone. And I will never find, I'm going to go and I'm going to hit search, right? My business email, so we have an AI spam filter. And this thing is beautiful. It cut noise down to like 1% of what it was before. And still, I have to fight unsubscribe, unsubscribe, unsubscribe. You know, and obviously I could create a filter, throw it all in there, but I don't know. I don't know why I haven't done that yet. Maybe there's one or two that I want. And that's me, right? I'm not yet at the position where like I've hired a full-time executive assistant to like filter out the rest of it, right? And then texts, my number has been around for the dawn of era. It's been leaked at least once or twice. I can't tell you the quantity of your funding has been approved and your and that's text. So it's interesting because I honestly have this thought in my head of like, are we legitimately going to end up where face-to-face is the only medium we're capable of having connection on?
Yeah, no, I mean, I you know, I've thought about this too. When you think about AI and you think about, I'm sure there's entire plots of movies that have gone down this way, but you think about even like how good video AI is, right? You can make anything look like anything, all these deep fakes, whatever else. And so you do start to have a, you know, it used to be where people were like, well, don't believe everything you read on the internet, right? Like legitimately, they would say that as like, it's not all true, like, right? Like, because the standards for publishing in a paper or whatever else were that much higher. Now it's like the standard for content online is whatever you can type with your thumbs, right? There's no one's checking it. These organizations like Instagram and Facebook are actively like getting rid of their content moderation departments, right? So it gets to be a point where, yeah, you do, like, you know, I think the internet will be, or online will be useful to get you to a certain point in the buyer's journey. But especially when it comes to really large purchases, nobody's going to self-serve on a website for $10,000, right? Like, there's just, and it's like, oh, I'll never talk to a human. I'll put in my bank information and just wire that money and start the contract on Monday. Like, there still is going to have to be, and to your point, probably that closing, that crucial part of, like, getting it over the hump is like, okay, I'm a person. It's face-to-face. Let's meet. I want to know that I can trust you, that sort of stuff, because online you can be whoever you want to be, which is great for some people, but can be really bad for consumers. So you just have to be more skeptical, especially with all of the different ways that people can get spammed out there, right? Like, you, I mean, I'm sure that's something you deal with a lot through the IT side, right? It's like I've worked for a bank and a utility company and a telephone company, and it's like the amount of scams that people try and pull, right? You know, as a way to get people to fork over money is ever increasing. Half my texts now, I feel like, are a scam that's, you know, hey, you know, you ran this toll, all right? Or it's like, hey, we found a job at Amazon you'd be perfect for. And it's like nothing to do with what my actual background is. So I think that's the human element is going to continue to be an important part. And that part will probably shift from, hey, I'm at the very beginning of the sale, making sure, hey, educational, and maybe the AI is the educational part, but that human being has to be there for the relationship part, which is obviously as big a part of business as any other. So,
yeah, it'll be fun. It'll be fun. Well, I'm trying to decide. This podcast definitely went a different direction than normal. I love that we got into it though, because it's fun and it's fascinated me, and it's something that I think about pretty regularly, because it's just, it's very real to what I do. Unless you have something in particular we need to get back to, I think we start to move to wrap up.
Yeah, I'm good with that. Yeah, if you feel like we got some good stuff. Yeah,
I think we got some great stuff, and I'm glad we definitely got to your current thing earlier on and the depth of that, because right about now I'd have been feeling really awkward. Okay, so there's two questions we like to wrap up this podcast with. So in your journey here, you've come a long way. Where you're at now, I love it. We have a saying here that goes, if we have seen further, it's by standing on the shoulders of giants. Who's been a giant in your life that you'd like to pay homage to in this moment?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, I've had a lot of people throughout my life that have, both in, you know, my job and my career, and then also family, that have been just really, really supportive. You know, the easy answer, I feel like I have to say this out of obligation, is my mom and dad. Obviously, like, they've been huge. They were so supportive of everything that I've done. They've been very supportive with the Street Sport KC and helping people, you know, find us, and just really being great advocates for it. I would say probably, like, from a mentor perspective with my career, just learning a lot, I think, about business would be the Eric Johnson is a man that I report to now as part of my day job, and him and I have just a great relationship. And I think there's just a lot that you can learn from other people if you're willing to open your ears. You know what I mean? Like, I think it's very easy once you reach a certain level, maybe, where you're just like, well, I know everything, and you know, you can kind of become like ChatGPT, where you become very defensive of like, no, this is my idea and I'm going to advocate for it. And I think it's really nice to be able to learn from people that have a lot of experience and that can teach you not just the work, right, but also like human interaction. Like, how do you get things done, and being, you know, how to be a diplomat at work to be able to accomplish the things that you need to. Because, you know, if you want to go, you know, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together, right? So you have to bring people into your corner, and you can do more stuff together. And so I think that's a big part of what I've learned, is just how do we, you know, how do I find the people in my life that are willing to help me, and how do I listen to them, and how do I get, you know, as much buy-in and information from them as I can, so that I can, you know, accomplish what I want to accomplish. So kind of a long-winded answer of my parents and my current manager. So
I don't know if I'd heard that term before. If you want to go fast, go long, or go lone. If you want to go far, go together.
Yeah. Mm. I think teamwork is a really big part of just accomplishing anything, right? And whether it's with AI, right? Or whether it's with actual other human beings, like, being able to collaborate and take an idea that you have and be able to add other pieces to it and go farther, I think, is always more beneficial than just trying to, you know, play hero ball and be like, I got this. Everybody else get away.
Well, and I have this internal saying, yeah, because AI, you know, it's, I have this internal saying that's like, if I wanted menial task repetition, I'd build robots.
Yeah.
If I want autonomy, I hire humans. Yeah. You know, AI, it's limited to you still. You've just given yourself a fancy tool that's going to be limited to you.
That understands.
Like, right. Yeah. And this is where people are beautiful. And autonomy is beautiful because it's like more people, more autonomy.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. So the last question, and I think you've already given us a couple here, but if there was one like pithy saying that you found to be true again and again and again, that's kind of helped guide you in life, what would that be?
There's a few that come to mind. I would say the one that I really like is that in order to get where other people haven't been, you have to do what other people haven't done, right? So if success was easy, then everybody would do it, right? It's like, what can I do that's really hard that other people may not be willing to do? Because that's where I can be successful. So are there things like, you know, are there things like, you know, when it comes to the nonprofit, can I fill out extra grants? You know, can I write city council members? Can I do things that maybe other organizations that are on my level right now aren't willing to do? Because over time, if I do enough of them, I'll be successful and be farther than where that organization is at. So I think it's just, you have to learn to do stuff that other people aren't willing to do, because that's the only way you can get farther and be successful and get where other people haven't been, is by taking a chance and doing things that may seem hard, but at the end, that's what's going to be lead to your success.
I like that. Cool.
Welcome to Steal It.
All right, Matthew. Well, I've appreciated so much having you on. Thank you so much for being here with me today.
Yeah, this is great. Thanks, Sam. I appreciate it. Big fan of your show, and I always enjoy our chats. Very, very interesting.
Love it.
Awesome.
Bye, everybody.
Hello, everyone. I wanted to thank you for listening to today's episode. It's such a blessing to be able to interview some such fantastic individuals. If you're interested in listening to more, we look to post every Thursday at 10 a.m. You can find us on YouTube, Amazon Music, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. Thanks so much. Have a blessed day.